Don't be silly. You're taking the fall.
My name is Stephen Nestor, and you're listening to Poets of the Tabloid Murder. Today we have with us Brian Whiprud, author of Stuffed, a Dell paperback publication, and Whiprud's second novel featuring taxidermist collector Garth Carson. A red herring turns out to be a white crow as North Koreans, carnies, sideshow freaks, the mysterious Jimmy Kim, and just about every United States government agency with an acronym get involved in the chase for a bird that holds in its claws alone a secret people are willing to kill for. Nice to have you back on the show, Brian.
Oh, well, thanks for having me, Steve.
Brian, I've got to say, you've staked out a unique piece of territory with your mysteries in that your main protagonist is kind of a freelance kind of guy. He's a freelance taxidermist, taxidermist repair guy, taxidermist renter-outer, and I've never heard of such a job in my life.
There are actually places in Manhattan here that do this, and for theatrical productions, photo shoots, you know, commercials, all that kind of stuff. Sometimes they need, they need animals, and rather than use a live one, it's a lot safer a lot of times and a lot cheaper just to rent a dead one.
Are you a taxidermist aficionado?
Well, I'm sort of winnowing down my collection at the moment. It was just getting too crazy, just down to my prime stuff. But I've collected taxidermy for 30 years, and it started with just like with Garth, with some inherited pieces from my grandfather, who was a hunter. I don't hunt; I just like the taxidermy, and so it sort of grew from there.
You know, one time my father came home with an object, and I thought it was unique. But then I saw another one, and it was a stuffed mongoose, and wrapped around this mongoose in doing battle with it was a stuffed cobra.
Yeah, that's very common. Yeah. The cobra mongoose pieces, mostly from India, and they're usually kind of beat up. I mean, it's hard to find one where the cobra isn't broken somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I know. After I saw the second one, I knew it wasn't unique. And plus, you know, the cobra's mouth was sewn shut. You know, it looked like I had sewn it shut. There's string hanging off, and it was a novelty. You know, he put it on the mantle in the living room for a couple of days until my mother tossed it out.
I bet she did.
Or my brother brought it up to his Syracuse frat house, and it was esteemed and appreciated up there.
Yeah, before finally in some sort of drunken thing, it all got broken, I'm sure.
Or somebody shot it or something.
Right.
So what was the inspiration behind this book? In your book number one, Pipsqueak, you wrote about a stuffed TV squirrel, which was a mascot of a 1950s, kind of like a Howdy Doody show. And you got into some, you know, New York, you got basically into New York subculture of retro people, you know, swing dancers, so on and so forth. But this book is a lot different. And I don't want to give too much away, but you get into a little bit of international intrigue. And I think you've expanded your range a little bit with characters and with plot. It's a long book, too. It's almost 400 pages. But what was the inspiration behind this one?
Well, I mean, as is often the case, are things that interest me. Certain subcultures and things like, you know, carnival people and sideshows have always interested me. And it's sort of a touchstone also. As with the first one, with Pipsqueak, you know, a puppet from a TV show when you were a kid. This also I have a very, very strong attachment to because when I was a child, I used to go to the state fairs, which they had these sideshows, and my brother and I used to just love them. I mean, we were really attached to them and knew them all, and you say, well, this time I want to go see the Fiji Mermaid, or I want to go see that, so that's one touchstone. The other was I wanted to try to write a slightly darker novel, something like a dark thriller with comic elements, or a comic dark thriller, and so in that I realized that to achieve that the menace had to be much more sinister, so that's basically how I came up with this idea to do that. All sorts of things relate to actual things I've encountered. Like I encountered a white crow in a bell jar once, and I also wanted to add elements of cryptozoology, which is animals that are thought to be extinct.
Well, we're going to talk about cryptozoology a little bit later because, you know, as a youngster with a great imagination and a subscription to Boy's Life back in the 60s, I was pretty up on my cryptozoology.
Oh, yeah. I think all of us were Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster and all that.
And yeah, there's let's have that conversation now.
Okay.
There's a book in the Central Avenue Elementary School library called Maybe Monsters. And it had like a tiger that lived in
Tasmania.
In Tasmania.
Yeah, it's really more like a dog.
It had like all sorts of critters in Burma, but it did have the Loch Ness Monster, it had Sasquatch, and it had the Abominable Snowman. And you know, this stuff was just, I mean, I couldn't get enough of it. I mean, I had a couple of books on the Abominable Snowman. It was, and me and my friend John Peterson, we just knew everything you could possibly know about the Yeti. You know, I think we learned about it from a Johnny Quest episode.
Right, I remember that, yeah.
And then after that, man, it was off to the races.
It was purely Abominable Snowman, not Bigfoot and the Patterson film.
John's father used to get like Saga and True Magazine. And every couple of months, they'd run an article about, you know, the Patterson movie, which, why don't you explain to our listeners what that is? Because it is a renowned piece of...
Oh, it's just the most famous Sasquatch film there is. And much debated, much studied 8mm film from the early 70s in which Sasquatch was... And it's the only one that looked anywhere near real. To me, it looks incredibly genuine just because the animal's fully fleshed out. I mean, all the other ones you see, you know, Sasquatch looks kind of skinny, like a man in a skin diving suit, but this has there's just something about it, the way it walks and everything, that seems genuine.
I think a couple of years ago, didn't somebody come out and finally like debunk it and say, yeah, I was in on this Roger Patterson movie, I was a guy who wore the big shoes that made footprints. I think someone came out and said that, you know,
right. That happened recently, and he gave an account of it, but that's even in debate because it turns out that all sorts of a lot of the facts, or the supposed facts, were contradicted. Apparently, certain people weren't actually there in that area at that time. They were working, and people can, you know, it's proved by work records that they weren't even there, or something like that.
Okay, we're going to ask you, Brian Whiprude, Sasquatch, yes or no, myth or truth?
Let me see. Today's Monday, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Monday. Yes, then it's true.
All right. Hey, don't get smart with me, mister. We got people out there who want to know the answers to this question. Okay. And another question I have. What's the difference between a rock and a boulder?
A rock and a boulder. Yeah. Well, a rock you can... a rock and a boulder. Okay.
Yeah. Remember?
Yeah, so I remember, yeah. A boulder, you need a machine to lift. And a rock you can actually lift up with your hands.
Okay, my point is that when you've read Pipsqueak, and if you are going to read Stuffed, I mean, there's just so much so many little factoids you toss around there that keep the book interesting. And it's not because the plot needs any bolstering up; it's that you're able to fit these little gems of knowledge into the book. And how do they come to you, and how do you integrate them into your plot? Is what really makes them kind of a nice, seamless little addition. And do you have the dictionary of arcane knowledge that your side, or these things just pop into your head?
No, these are just things that pop into my head. And I for me, it's when Garth gets nervous, he starts concentrating, or he's agitated, he suddenly starts concentrating on something that has nothing to do with what's going on really on at the moment, except for the fact that he may have a boulder on the trunk of his car. But in the book I'm working on now, he's suddenly, they're approaching Omaha in a car. Don't ask me, but they're putting to go to a Mexican wrestling match, and they're worried about tornadoes, and Gar suddenly starts getting into all that, and you know, his brother has to tell him to shut up.
Well, one thing you do talk about on a more serious note is you've got to be a bit of an animal activist, or you're not quite a PETA guy, I think, but you really are. Are concerned about animal chop shops, and tell us
right.
What they are.
Well, exotic animals are often parts of their bodies, paws, tongues, and various organs, especially gallbladders, are used in Chinese folk medicine, which is still extremely popular in Chinese and other Asian cultures, and they also include penises, like tiger penis and that kind of thing. Most of what you see, what's sold like in Chinatown, and when it's analyzed by agents from U.S. Fish and Wildlife, turns out to be something like cornstarch. But it does demand quite a large price. And so there are places which actually will, secretly import in exotic animals and take these parts to make these medicines. They will also take the pelts and things in order to make, coats, jackets, that kind of thing. And so, like a leopard skin jacket is obviously illegal, but if they will import them and people will buy them.
Well, have you ever been approached by anybody from the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife? You know, like maybe a fan who's a guy who's read your book and he likes it and he says, "Hey, come hang out with me for one day and and see what I do as I travel through maybe New York City or wherever." I mean, it would seem like it's such a natural thing to do, and it would be a great way to get some research done as well.
Yeah, it would. In some ways. I don't know, maybe it was Lee Child that said this, but he doesn't like being limited by research. That's one way of doing it, but then sometimes it can limit you, trying to stay too true to things, to the way things actually are. No, I haven't been contacted by anybody from U.S. Fish and Wildlife, or by any taxidermist for that matter, saying, "Hey, you can't brush a tiger's lips like that."
Yeah. Hey, but you know what? But that's not how the imagination works. You're gonna go, you would follow somebody around, and he would do A, B, C, D. But by the time you got finished with it, it would be X, Y, Z. Because your imagination is gonna take right over and just use, I think, the whatever events transpired as a springboard into to whatever your subconscious tells you to do.
Right. Yeah. I could do that. There are people here in New York City. Years ago, when I contacted them, basically trying to get down the particulars that I sometimes sketch out in the book of what it takes to own exotic taxidermy. Their first answer was, "Well, you shouldn't own any anyway." I said, "But it's legal, isn't it? Under certain circumstances, yes. But it's just better if you just don't own it." I was like, "Yes, okay. But I'm trying to get to the bottom of this.
Why should you not own it?" Were they saying that like
just because it makes more problems for them? You shouldn't really be buying this. And it's like, "Well, if it's for educational purposes, I can buy it, can I?" "Well, I suppose you can, but it's really not a good idea." It's just that kind of stuff. I was just getting sort of an official, hitting an official wall.
Yeah, he took his fist and mashed it into his hand, open hand. Making that nice little,
right.
You really don't want to own that.
That's right. I wouldn't be doing that if I were you,
I forgot about it. Hey, what could I buy right now in New York City, illegal, if I had enough money?
I would imagine just about anything, especially, if you could make the right connections and not end up getting connected with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife and getting arrested.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. Let's push the envelope just so much here.
Well, you can certainly buy bear gallbladders. I'm quite certain of that, which you would have to pay up to like $40,000 for a really good one.
Ouch.
One about the size of a mid-sized dog turd.
What breed of dog? No, never mind. Come on.
Not a lab, but...
Okay. All right. Terrier.
Yeah.
But does the Museum of Natural History ever have a garage sale? I mean, do they ever clean their attic out? And I'm sure you must be in that space.
I have seen the drawers where they keep all their, they just have drawer upon drawers of parrots and drawers upon drawers of all kinds of exotic critters. But they would never be able to sell them since a lot of them are now protected under various acts, not necessarily endangered, but protected. So they would only be able to sell them to another educational institution.
Oh, shucks.
Yeah.
Well, my name is Stephen Ester, and we're speaking with Brian Whiprude, author of Stuffed. This is a Dell paperback original, and this is Poets of the Tabloid Murder. Or I guess if you couldn't sneak into the Museum of Natural History, you could just go to one of those places like the Bone Shop or whatever. People just love dead things. I mean, I remember... going through a junk store in Montclair, New Jersey, and there was a, you know, the classic waste paper basket made out of an elephant's foot, you know, which was, I thought was kind of hideous. But we like, why do we like to take animals, shoot them, and then make decorations out of their hides?
Well, I think in some ways it's the only way that you can, in person, get up close and personal with these animals. I mean, they're, you know, like an eland or something like that is a beautiful antelope. And in your living room, you get to admire it and look at it for, you know, for longer periods of time, and actually then to touch it and feel the texture of the horns and all that. You go to Africa and you just see one, and it's fleeting, you know.
And you're swatting flies.
Yes, tsetse flies, yeah.
But I think that I think people don't really admire the animal. They admire what the animal says about the person whose house it's in. In other words, you know, if you have a wall full of trophies, you're going to want to come off as kind of like a, you know, a wealthy, you know, sportsman, connoisseur, man of action kind of thing, you know?
Right, well, to some degree, yeah. I mean, it depends on how it's displayed and whether you shot it yourself. I mean, I don't hunt, and so I've never shot anything, much less any of the taxidermy in my home. But yeah, big game hunters, that's a whole different story. Then it's a trophy, not just... It's not just a part of an exotic decor or part of a collection. They have a little, they, you know, it depends on the big game hunter, but a lot of them are very competitive about it. And it's an extremely expensive sport shooting exotics.
I mean, let me ask a question. I mean, can mounted animals be equated to like rare volumes of books? In other words, can a book signed by Teddy Roosevelt or Carl Ackley, is that as valuable as an animal shot by one of these guys? You know, do they have that kind of cachet? You know, this is the lion that Joe DiMaggio shot on his honeymoon. Okay.
Right. Yes, I would think they would. I just saw that three paintings by a chimp named Bongo or whatever, or Congo, were just sold at auction for $25,000. So,
son of a gun. Well, listen. What was the? You wrote book number one, and people are. I mean, people are just interested in how a writer works, how they get their book out of their head onto the paper and into the marketplace. I mean, you wrote your first book, and which was actually well received. We all know that. But what was the story with the second book? Was it as difficult to write? And what was the odyssey to getting this book published?
Well, this is the second book of my first contract. I already had, you know, parts of this book written, but not complete. I dive into a book, I start writing it without knowing necessarily what the book is really going to be about or where it's going. I have more or less have an opening scene, and I sort of feel my way along, and then other ideas come to me, and I work them in, and then I usually work myself into the middle of the book, where I'm completely lost, and then I spend waste a lot of time charting where all the characters are and what's going on, and that's just, I'm just procrastinating until I realize what the book is really about, as opposed to, you know, things that are just happening. And so I go, there's a lot of back and forth until finally I get over the hump in the center, and then it's just downhill. I know what's going to happen.
How do you know that point has been reached, that you, when you realize, you know, what the book is about?
It's usually when it's about what it's not about on the surface, or about what it's going on a little bit deeper, about what's going on with our protagonist emotionally, and about what his catharsis is going to be from this. I mean, this has a lot to do with how he feels about Angie, his girlfriend, longtime girlfriend, and about his own insecurities about how he's been holding her back from her career, and this whole, you know, thing where he has, I don't want to spoil it, but so it's finding what the deeper meaning about what the characters are all striving for, and how they're going to realize what they're trying to attain.
Well, Garth, I think he's having trouble. He's not having a midlife crisis, but he's just having trouble. I think he's facing what everybody's facing, I think, guys who are there approaching 40 or of that certain age, is that, you know, he has trouble people calling him Mister, and he doesn't think he's this quite different from he was maybe 20 years ago. So the way he thinks, talks, the things he does kind of reflect that. You know, he is having trouble, you know, really maturing. And that seems to be a problem with him throughout this entire book.
Right, yeah. That's exactly it. That's it also. I like to say sometimes about my books, when sometimes people read them and they go, wow, I was kind of surprised that it was, you know, that it, you know, I wasn't quite expecting it to be like this. And because it's also a serious book. I mean, it's about some serious things. It can be very funny, but also be about some serious, you know, issues about love, about, you know, insecurities, about where your life is going, about midlife crises. And I try to flesh it out. And what I try to say is, it's a crime, you know, humorous crime thriller, but with soul.
Okay, because Garth does have an opportunity, and I won't give it away, but he does have an opportunity to grow up, and he kind of, I won't tell you what happens, but let's get back to the act of writing, and you're writing a series. This is book number two. I'm going to assume you're on book number three of the series, but does it ever happen that you're writing a book in a series, and all of a sudden, you know, you've got to take part of this book that you're working on and set it aside because, you know, you're working, we can assume you're writing the entire life and times of a character, you know, and stretched over as many books as you write in the series. So have you ever been writing and you're writing your series and all of a sudden you say, this is not part of the book. This is another book. This is another circumstance that I'm going to save for another book featuring Garth Carson. And so, and let me just try and get back to book number two. Have you ever experienced that before?
No, not really. I think, I don't really get. I haven't really gotten ahead of myself with Garth because I'm, you know, the growth of his character, you know, is sequential for me. This book, true, was a prequel, but I had already thought out his character up to this point before I got to Pipsqueak, which is the first book. But now, he hasn't evolved any further for me than the present.
Well, series in general seem to be the thing of westerns, romance writers, mystery writers, you know, genre books. I mean, are you ever going to want to break out of this mold? Are you interested in pursuing other things? I mean, I could see you writing, you know, nonfiction books with your interest in this subject matter of.
I really don't have that much interest in nonfiction. What I'm trying to do within this subgenre actually is do subgenres within subgenres. Stuffed was I had it very much in mind that it was going to be that I wanted to write a thriller, because Pipsqueak wasn't really a thriller; it was a little bit more of a caper. This is more of a thriller. The next one, which is I believe going to be called Crooks, and we're still debating it, is mainly about Garth's brother Nicholas. This is the one that comes out next June. And it's more of a straight detective fiction in a way. Garth and Angie do appear as his Otto and stuff. But then the book I'm actually working on now, I haven't got my edits for Crooks yet. But the book I'm working on now, White Gecko, is a serial killer book in which big game hunters. This relates to what we were talking about before, are being killed by their own trophies.
Interesting. This is Garth Carson.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, tell us about a little bit about the editorial process. When you finish writing a book, and you deliver it to the publishing house, is it completely done, or you hand it to your editor? Do they pick it over and ask you to rewrite, or they change things, or is it just a complete book once you're done with it? I mean, are you?
It depends on the book. Pipsqueak stuff was a little less done than there were a lot more revisions that I ended up making than I did with Pipsqueak when I went to the editor. It was a little bit more of a struggle to make it come out as smoothly and as nicely as it is. My editor, Caitlin Alexander at Bantam, is just terrific, and she was, you know, so she worked a lot with her. I think she was pretty exhausted by the end. I think next year's book is a lot more complete than that. We'll find out when she sends the edits in. But usually with a book, my agent first looks at it because he wants to get psyched about it. And there's a little back and forth where he may make a few comments, this, that, and the other, and I may or may not incorporate some of them. And then There's a point where he'll say, yeah, okay, I think this is, you know, go ahead and send it to her, you know. And so I'll send it to her, and then she looks at it, and then I just forget about it for a while because it takes a couple months. And then I start in writing, you know, another book. And then suddenly it lands back on my desk, and I try to ignore it, but I can't. I can't go back to the other book until I see what she had to say. And so that will probably take, you know, 6 weeks of working on that. And then I come back to what I'm, you know, the fresh stuff I'm working on now. And that actually works out really well because it gives me rest. You know, I try to, like, work towards the middle of the book where I get stuck, so that when her comments come in, that's a perfect time to take a break and then come back to it and suddenly have all sorts of brilliant or not-so-brilliant ideas.
Well, do you ever want to take a break by, you know, writing short fiction or, you know, newspaper or, you know, magazine articles, something like that to distract you but, you know, just keep you in tune?
Oh, yeah. I write a lot of fishing articles on fly fishing. This year, I didn't get any of the glossies this year, but last year I was in Fly Fisherman and Fly Tire magazine. So I do write some nonfiction, just articles, though. I did also have a short story coming out next year in an anthology J.A. Conrath is putting together this anthology, and I have a story in there.
So tell me, how many stuffed animals can I find at the Brimfield Fair? Because next time you're up at Brimfield, you have to stop by WHUS and say hello to us.
There's one guy in particular. I haven't been there in a few years. One guy in particular, I think his name is Lou or something. I've lost his card, but you know, you seek him out, and he's just got tons of stuff, tons of used taxidermy. And then you see it, you know, here and there, all over the rest of the fair. But he's got like the mother load, and you go over there and you say, I'll take this, that, and then he puts together a package. And I say, how much is this? And it was $75, and I put that for, you know, say, okay, you know, I'll put a post-it on it or something, and then I get a bunch of stuff, and he's already told me the price of it. Then he looks at it and goes, you know, give me $800.
Well, tell me, the moose head seems to be the unobtainable ideal. You know, it's like the guy chasing after the butterfly in your book. Do you have a moose head in your collection?
In Stuffed, it's that's the Garth is.
The unobtainable ideal.
Has been, sorry?
The unobtainable ideal.
Yes, he's been looking for the $50 moose head because he keeps hearing about them, that somebody bought a moose head for $50 at a tag sale, and he's been looking for this $50 moose head. He could buy any moose head he wants at any time for, you know, $1,200, a museum-quality one for maybe $1,800, but he wants that $50 moose head because he's a Wheeler dealer.
Yeah, no self-respecting animal trader would buy it, the $1,200 moose head.
Right.
That's for the suckers. Anyway, we've been speaking with Brian Whiprude, author of Stuffed, a Dell paperback original. Brian, thanks for being on the show.
Hey, it's terrific, Stephen. Anytime.
Okay, let us know when your next book comes out. We'll have you on.
I'm all over it.
Okay, my name is Stephen Nestor, and you've been listening to Poets of the Tabloid Murder.